again. We got a packed show today, and we've got at the back end of the show, we're going to be hearing from Andy Z. You know, I'll tell you a little bit more about it later, but there's been a lot of discussion and wrestling with Donald Trump's comments about Jewish people, including if Jews vote for Democrats, are they being disloyal? And in doing this, he has trafficked in anti-Semitism. I'll go back to this a little bit later, but we'll be talking with Andy Z about that for a short bit of time. I understand he has some very sharp comments on that and things that people need to hear.
And before that, we'll be talking with Mike Ludwig, a reporter with truthout.org, about a recent decision by Trump to change regulations on the detention of immigrant families seeking asylum. These new rules would allow children to be held indefinitely in the regime's concentration camps.
But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome to this show someone who I just, you know, looking around and we found this person and I was trying to figure out what we really needed to do on the show today. And in particular around immigrants and immigration. And I came upon a group called Detention Watch Network, which is a national coalition of organizations and individuals working to expose and challenge the injustices of the U.S. immigration detention and deportation system and advocate for profound change that promotes the rights and dignity of all people. And joining us to talk about this is Silky Shah, who's the executive director of the Detention Watch Network. Silky, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to be here with you.
Sure. I have about a million questions for you, so we're going to jump right into it. The first one, the U.S. maintains, you know, and this is, I kept thinking about this as I went through what you've been writing and what, you know, and what's on your website. The U.S. maintains the largest immigration detention system in the world. Give people an idea of what this is. Who are the people and what it looks like?
Sure. So right now, like basically we have about 55,000 people in ICE detention, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention. But if you look at like the overall system of incarceration, just more and more in all these different agencies, you're seeing more immigrants being incarcerated, both in the ICE detention system, in the Customs and Border Protection detention, in Office of Refugee Resettlement Facilities for unaccompanied children, and then also in the U.S. Marshals Service and Bureau of Prisons for people who are convicted of immigration crimes. And so you just, overall, the U.S. is just really leading the way on immigrant incarceration. And in terms of the ICE detention system, which is what we focus on the most, currently there's about 55,000 people detained. That is a 17,000-bed increase since the end of the Obama term. So a huge, a massive, massive expansion under Trump. So we were about 38,000 beds at the end of Obama. And what that means is, you know, in terms of numbers of people, to give you a sense over the course of the year, you might have people who are in detention for 2 weeks. You might have people who are in detention for a month. And then you also have a set of people who are in detention for months or sometimes even years. And the reason why people are in detention in the ICE detention system is because it's essentially pretrial detention. They're waiting to determine their immigration status. So it's mostly about compliance. So it actually has nothing to do with quote-unquote punishment or serving time for a crime. It's really a system that exists to make sure, ensures somebody shows up to their hearing or ensures that somebody is deported. So that's a really alarming thing, especially when you have people in detention for months and months or even several years that we've seen. So over the course of the year, you could have anywhere from like 300,000 to 400,000 people detained in the system, which, yes, is absolutely the largest in the world.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, it's actually mind-blowing when you, you know, I'm sitting here and I've read a lot over the last few months and stuff about this, but just to hear that figure again is something that really is mind-blowing. I think very few people understand the sort of the enormity of what's going on. And this is something that got me because even there's what's going on by the, you know, government-sponsored organizations or whatever, the, you know, different figures they have that can go out and do this. Then they also hire these subcontractors, which is that, does that add on to what you've been talking about?
No, I mean, so it's a part of, the subcontractors are within those numbers, but the truth is, yeah, so basically ICE detention is about 200-plus jails all over the country. And to be really clear, it's jails and or, as some people refer to them as camps, but it's a lot of them are actually county jails that are used. The vast majority are. And so of the 200-plus facilities, only 5 are owned and operated by ICE. Every single other facility is subcontracted out either to private prison companies, which a lot of people hear about, Geo Group, CoreCivic, both of which have had name changes over the last 15 years to deal with their images, and some other smaller private prison companies, as well as county jails. And so counties that are sort of cash-strapped looking for federal dollars, they'll also use their bed space to detain people.
Now, what are the conditions that people face in these prisons?
Yeah. I think one thing to name about just sort of the context, especially in the context of people being in for long periods of time. Again, these are county jails. So county jails exist for the purpose of people being in for short period of times prior to their sentencing, et cetera. And so they don't have similar services to you that you'd have in like a prison, educational services, all that kind of stuff. I mean, I think there's just generally, conditions-wise, I think it's a combination of really poor conditions and also just like a complete lack of dignity. And so when you look at conditions, I mean, I think at the top of the list, people will name medical care and mental health care, which has led to, over 190 negligent deaths since 2003, or not all negligent deaths, but 190 deaths since 2003, many of which have been suicides. And there's more and more reports sort of coming out about the support that's offered to people with mental illness and automatically putting them in solitary confinement, which also exacerbates the instances of suicide. So that's like we're on the sort of like egregious side, really the worst of the system. But then there's just all this other stuff, really terrible food, instances of maggots in food or moldy food, not getting like clean clothing, women not getting like sanitary napkins, like just general hygiene issues. In general with medical care, like the answer is often like, here, we're just going to give you an Advil to deal with like any issue that's coming up. And then you also have places like Etowah in Alabama where the inspections officer comes in and says outdoor recreation exists when in fact it's a room with a window. And that's a facility where most people are on appeal. So I've known people who've spent 7 years in that facility and haven't been able to go outside at all. You have, like video visitation only in a lot of places because they're trying to cut costs. And so you have a loved one traveling 3 hours, 6 hours, maybe flying to see, their loved one before they're about to be deported, and they get there and, they can't even be there in person with them. They have to talk to them through a video even when they're at the facility. And then I think there's like other more egregious violations that you'll hear of, which is abuse by guards, sexual abuse that has happened as well, just treatment of pregnant women has been, pregnant women being shackled, just a whole range of things. But, really like the thing to note is that there's a set of detention standards that exist, but they're not codified, which means that you can't really hold these, either county jails or companies accountable. And the inspections process that does exist is operated by ICE, and it's basically a sham process.
Yeah. It's very, I'm thinking about some of the things that you've said around this, where you said that Trump will stop at nothing to perpetuate immigrant suffering, which I think you're actually detailing. But it's also this thing of the changes under Trump, the role of detention as a primary means, even family detention under Trump. This is a huge thing, especially with these latest round of laws that he's trying to push mm-hmm. through.
Yeah, no, I mean, family detention did come back under the Obama era. So initially under Obama, I mean, it's been an interesting ride for detention. So if you look at the detention system as we know it today, it's really started to exist in this way in the 80s, which was really a strong relationship between the rise of mass incarceration in this country. So you can't ignore that the role that that has played in immigration detention and its growth. But really a set of laws that passed in the Clinton era, the 1996 immigration laws, have sort of laid the foundation for where we're at today. And then Bush era was, like the creation of DHS and ICE and just like we're going to funnel a ton of money into this. But it was really chaotic. People didn't know what was happening with the system. And then Obama came in and was like, I'm going to be transparent. I'm going to do some reforms to make these facilities better. But detention expanded under that period. And in 2014, he brought back family detention in full force with the opening of Dilley and Carnes in Texas and Artesia in New Mexico. And you know, all of those instances were quite horrific. And I think, you know, a lot of those, that time, the intention was also deterrence. So I think, yes, absolutely, Trump is making it so much worse, and I can get into that in a second. But there's no question that a lot of that stuff, the seeds of it were, you know, under Democratic presidents and especially Clinton and Obama, and now we've handed it to, you know, Trump, who is like, we're just caricatures of evil, and we're trying to do everything we can to make it impossible for immigrants to, you know, be treated humanely. And so I think these most recent, like the Flores rule and the shifting of that, in so many ways is like, you read the language and it's basically like, we can do whatever we want. Like, basically the rule is we have the ability to do what we want. And like, it's true for the amount of time you can detain children. So initially it was like, you can't detain them for more than 21 days. And now they're saying, well, we can detain them indefinitely. But another one is around state licensure. So one of the tactics that Texas groups use to fight back against these facilities in Texas was saying, hey, actually, you have these children in these facilities, but they aren't licensed by the state as child care facilities, and therefore they should be shut down. And so basically in this new rule, they're saying, actually, state licensure just doesn't matter anymore. So that's kind of where they're going with everything they're doing, everything they're putting out. It's like anytime we've tried to fight back, they're doing everything they can to circumvent those tactics to fight back.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that struck me as I was reading up on this and reading some of the stuff that your group has put out and other places, you know, this whole point about, you know, and it's something that people, I don't think, concentrate on or they actually recognize right away. And more people need to recognize the similarity between concentration camps and what the hell is going on now with all these people. And it's been, yes, there's been a, you know, there's a long history to this, but there's also been a leap in this where you have ending birthright citizenship for children of immigrants, you know, gutting the 14th Amendment, the kinds of raids that they were doing like they did in Mississippi. This is a big leap in the character and the content of the kind of oppression that they're bringing down on people.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, it's not just the ways the laws are shifting, but it's the ways that we're talking about it and the ways that we think about it and the sort of deeper paradigm of scapegoating and targeting immigrants that feels akin, and I think this is the reason why people are bringing up things like concentration camps, or I think for folks in the U.S. who actually know about this history, Japanese internment in the 1940s, and just the way that it's really so much a targeting of a people and a growth of this sort of scapegoating to, and I think that the hard part about it is that you get so far, then, you know, our strategy is like, okay, well, like, there's no way to deny that this is about racism and this is about xenophobia and it's about white supremacy. So let's like put that all on the table and then say, actually, what do we really want? But I think sometimes the fear is that you go so far to the right that it's hard to bring people back. And I think that's what we saw, especially under the Obama era. And I think that we need to think about moving forward is we, you know, buying into these talking points that we need more border security or that we need more of these pieces, these things that are militarizing the border, dehumanizing people, when in fact, like, we've done that. All of that exists already. Everything that they're asking for more of, it already exists, and this is where we are now.
Well, especially when you look at this thing, I mean, one of the things that I think most people who have a heart and who can look at things in a sort of all-round way, when you've seen the kinds of things that actually, one, have been happening that you guys have been bringing out and exposing, which I think is extremely important, and please do not stop doing that, okay? But also the fact that these recent raids, the Mississippi raids, you know, there was a whole way that was carried out, and what was summed up in the systems press and all this other stuff about this, you know, that this was like, you know, this was sort of, all these people were here illegally and we're just cleaning things up and we're doing what we said we were going to do. And you actually had these people, I mean, babies and children, you know, separated from their parents, people who went to work, and hundreds of them, the largest thing that happened in relation to this. And where are the people in the streets saying, no, we're not going to do this. You know, this is not acceptable. Now, there are some examples, but this is really something for people to kind of think about. How long and how can we morally accept the kinds of things that are actually not being thought about, but actually being employed right now?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. I think, you know, it's been an interesting process as being somebody who's worked on the issue of detention for over 15 years, and now, like, people in my life actually know what I work on. There's, like, so much more context for people, but still not the outrage that we would hope for. And even last summer, I think it was a bit of a struggle with the family separation crisis because, you know, the default argument people were making often was, well, family detention is good because then families at least stay together. And it's like, why do we have to assume that detention is the answer? Why is that the default? I think the U.S. is a country that's so obsessed with punishment and really defaults to that, and it's hard for people to understand what to do, how to challenge that. And I think that's part of it sometimes whenever people aren't speaking up. They're like, well, it feels almost futile in the context of this administration, and how can we know that, you know, actually we need everybody to be fighting back as much as possible to change things. And so I think that's one of our tasks as well.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think actually one of the things that we're going to end up winding up on this, but I think one of the things that really struck me as I was reading the work that your group does and just examining what the hell has been happening in this. And I kept thinking about, you know, this situation of the, you know, this ethnic cleansing. It really is an ethnic cleansing of Latino immigrants, of citizens and Latino citizens, and driving this entire regime out is the greatest moral obligation. When you look at this, I think it's driving this regime out, to me, is the greatest moral obligation that we as humans have today. I wanted to, you know, end with your sort of thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. I think there's, I think there's a lot in the world that's a problem, but I think as we look at other things that could impact this, for instance, climate change and the sort of expansion of climate refugees and especially the way, I mean, you know, David Koch died today, and here we are, like, in this sort of instance where, you know, so much of the world is being impacted by some of the things that he was promoting, which it means that we're going to have even more immigration, more turmoil in the world, and we need to think about where we stand on this and how we can be, you know, a place that supports. We have abundance. We have the resources to support people, and that's what we really need to do. And we, yeah, I think that the question of being on the wrong side of history, all those other pieces are there. And so I guess that on a final note, I mean, I would encourage folks to go to Detention Watch Network, learn more about our campaigns. There are ways to fight back. And specifically, one of the things that we're really demanding right now is, well, two things in particular, which is getting Congress to stop, like, bankrolling all of this detention, which they've been doing blindly for years. So that's through our Defund Hate campaign, and then locally trying to fight back on expansion. So y'all are in California. There's a lot of detention expansion that's being proposed there, and so ways to fight back you can find out through our website and the Communities Not Cages campaign.
Okay. And Silke, I want to make sure that I make clear, really need to have you back on a regular basis here. So
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me on.
Great. And we'll be talking with you. All right?
Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been speaking with Silke Shah, Executive Director of the Detention Watch Network, and we've been talking about basically the fascist war against immigrants that's happening right now, and too many of us aren't even aware of this, all right?
That was International Noise Conspiracy with Let's Make History Tonight. And now we're going to continue with our discussion of what's happening to immigrants at the hands of the U.S. imperialists. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest, Mike Ludwig. And Mike writes for Truth Out, and Truth Out is, people can go to that, find out on the internet very easily. It's a very significant place where people can actually talk about the things that matter in the world. And Mike has been talking about one of the things that I think is a major, major point of concern, should be a major point of concern for anyone who has a progressive bone anywhere in their body, but anyone who has both a love of humanity and also a real deeper understanding and sometimes, you know, trying to figure out what the hell is going to go on with this system that we have right now and what's happening right now with the Trump-Pence regime and where they're taking things and the rise of fascism that's creeping up over the hills. And it's not even creeping anymore. It's more or less running on like five horses, okay? So we're here to talk about this latest thing that I saw of Mike's in Truth Out, and it was a piece that made me really want to talk to him. First of all, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, you recently wrote in Truth Out that the Trump administration recently finalized a rule that would actually finalize or make okay a draconian punishment for immigrants that would establish a whole new approach by the Trump regime towards the treatment of immigrant people seeking asylum in the U.S. Let's talk about this, because this is one of the, in a lot of ways, ironically, it's one of the most important things going on right now in terms of the way the world is actually sort of setting up. But it's also one of the things that's some of the most controversial stuff. And it's one of the things that I think is really a critical point that people need to be clear on and need to take a stand around in relation to immigrants and what's happening to them in this country.
Right. Well, last week, the Trump administration finalized some what they're calling, they're basically federal regulations. What they're trying to do is codify a longstanding agreement that people who've defended migrants, not only from indefinite incarceration, but trying to hold the government accountable for the conditions of incarceration, particularly at holding pens and the border. This is known as the Flores Settlement. It's been around for decades, and it's what lawyers keep going back to when we see large numbers of people seeking asylum. And we see draconian responses from the government. So the Trump administration wants to codify what they say are the standards that agreement holds the government to into a regulation that would allow them to meet these standards while incarcerating parents and children until they can see a judge. And it's already been challenged, and it's likely going to be caught in court for a while. There's going to be a lot of partisan fighting about it, because it's going to look ugly. It happened under the Obama administration. It was a flashpoint of controversy under Obama, and it would bound to be again. We've already seen what incarceration can do when you throw people seeking asylum into jails, even temporarily. What would it look like if they were held indefinitely until they could see a judge?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, though, that in particular with what's going on around immigrants, it actually has both the immediate, you know, impact on immigrant people themselves and people that are coming into the country and fleeing, you know, some horrifying situations in other countries, and also just a number of them who part of the horrifying situation is the fact that they can no longer live in those countries, even in terms of feeding themselves or their families. You have all this going on. But it's also there's a thing that's going on here that's very, very heavy, because, and it has everything to do with, and I'd like to talk with you about this, it has everything to do with what this actually will mean for immigrants, because, you know, they're terminating a decades old settlement that, you know, governed the treatment of migrant children and how immigrants are treated by federal agencies. That's all being changed now. I think it has a powerful negative impact on what's happening. What is the life of immigrants now? What is it that they're up against in terms of this regime, this regime, and what it intends to do?
Right. Well, I think the Trump administration would argue that they're basically reinstating a policy that was first put into place under Obama, where for about a year or so, families, certain migrant families, were incarcerated the entire time after showing up to the United States in basically family jails until they waited to see a judge. I think the administration keeps trying to say, well, we're just returning to this policy, but we're going to codify some regulations to make those accommodations better, make those basically family jails a bit better for folks. And this will accomplish two things. One, it will allow us to speed through their court hearings faster. And for Trump, that means speeding up deportation so he can go brag about it next year when he is running for re-election. And it will act as a deterrent for more people coming to the country. That's their argument, and they're not being shy about using deterrents, which, if that sounds inhumane, I think a lot of people would agree with you. And so what this means is if you're poor and you're from Central America and you're trying to seek asylum in the United States, you get frustrated waiting in a line behind 60,000 people at the Mexico border, and out of desperation, you try to get into the country undocumented and not waiting for specifically at the border, and you cross somewhere else, that means you're immediately incarcerated as soon as you're apprehended, and most people are basically surrendering themselves to the Border Patrol at this point, and you spend your entire stay in the United States locked up in a facility, possibly shipped around between 2, 3, 4 facilities as different contractors get their piece of the funding pie that comes with these kind of projects until you see a judge, and then the judge... And you may see one faster, but you're incarcerated the entire time with your children. That is this plan. But more broadly, what we're seeing is an expansion in incarceration in general. I mean, there won't just be migrants coming and being jailed more often under Trump policies. There'll be people who have been in the country for 2 years who are getting arrested. And even though they don't have a criminal record, they're getting sent to jail for indefinite periods of time until they see a judge. I've been reporting in Louisiana on a rapidly expanding apparatus of immigration jails there, not only on the people inside who've been organizing hunger strikes, but also on the conditions inside and also on the courts that oversee these jails and end up ruling in the cases on the people who are held there. And you look at the rates that judges will issue bonds under Trump, and they've just plummeted. So what is happening is we're seeing a wholesale expansion in incarceration as being part of the immigration process. And that matters for everyone, because even if you're a legal immigrant but your brother, sister, cousin isn't, you're looking at the threat of losing them basically to a jail hundreds of miles away where they have to pay collect for phone calls. And that, you know, destabilizes whole communities, not to mention families.
Well, tell me this, because, you know, I'm really hearing this, what you're saying, and I wanted to ask you, you know, there's a point here about, though, that this deterrence versus punishment and incarceration, and it's in all that is what's happening to people is really, really inhumane. It's not just a question of, you know, setting up rules and then being thrown into these rules, but there's actually a major question of the inhumane aspect of this, and you know, even more than, you know, some people will argue, well, this has been ineffective or anything like that, and you were speaking to that to a certain extent, but there is really a very important thing I think that people need to understand it about the inhumanity of what's being done to immigrants in the name of protecting the motherland or the fatherland, actually, at this point, you know?
Sure. I actually visited one of these facilities in Louisiana. This is not one of the facilities where they'd be detaining families under the policy we're talking about today. What this is actually a local jail run by a private company that, because of state-level reforms, actually emptied out a little bit of state prisoners in Louisiana. And in order to make extra money, they started taking in immigrants. In fact, local sheriffs in Louisiana who've been turning their jails into immigration jails have bragged about how immigrants are much better behaved than the prisoners that they usually have, and they'll gladly take the check from the federal government. And people I interviewed there described being put in solitary confinement for protesting, for organizing hunger strikes. They described not having access to interpreters, not being able to understand their legal documents. And at the end of the day, they just said, hey, how am I supposed to get a lawyer and fight my case? How am I supposed to get my documentation that I need for my asylum case for my family when I'm locked in a cage, when my freedom of movement is restricted? And I think we always need to ask ourselves what it means when the government is putting people basically in cages, what it means when our government is restricting people's movements. This jail in Louisiana is just a few miles away from a plantation where people's movement was also restricted, and white people in that area profited from essentially the incarceration, the captivity of their brown bodies. Now we see that replicated once more in a jail that is taking people in from all over the world, and probably wouldn't be had there not been a drastic change in policy.
Okay, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mike Ludwig from Truthout, and he's written extensively about the situation facing immigrants in Truthout. So check that out there. Here's a question for me. You know, it really gets to me because you have all these various levels, it seems, in relation to how the oppression and how the assault on immigrant people is coming down. Actually, one thing that's gotten a lot of attention, but I don't think really been something that people have picked up on or people have begun to really understand the character of this, and that is the particular role of ICE and the whole thing about family residential settlements, all the things that ICE is being let loose to do. Let's talk about that some.
Sure. No, ICE is at the center of this plan for indefinite family detention. Basically, the government would institute regulations at ICE that would allow ICE to run large, what they call family residential centers. I would call them specialized family jails, essentially. They're places that you go and you can't leave, but they might be a bit nicer than your county jail, right? There's more books. There's perhaps better health care, but that's only a promise that the government is making. There's a soccer field, but, you know, as we know, most jails also have yards for prisoners to go out into. And we saw these same facilities in use during the Obama administration, and they stopped. They stopped putting families in there because they faced so much backlash and so much criticism from human rights groups. But what would essentially happen under these regulations is that ICE would be able to hold families indefinitely as long as they met certain standards. And that could be in one of these large privately run jails in Texas. It could also be in other facilities across the United States, but they wouldn't necessarily have to be licensed with the state to provide child care services, even though children are the center of this policy, as long as a third-party entity that was, and I'm quoting from the Department of Homeland Security here, that is engaged by ICE, says that it meets the standards put forth by the administration, then it's kosher. They're allowed to stick families in there for as long as they want, until basically they can see a judge. Now, we already have attorneys general from 19 states and the District of Columbia have filed a lawsuit challenging this policy. Attorney Bob Ferguson, Attorney General of Washington, he spent some time, or at least investigators with his team spent some time interviewing migrant teenagers who had been held in the holding facilities down near the border. They came back with some of the same reports. You know, we don't have access to tampons, we don't have access to toothpaste, some of the things we've already heard in the media. And his civil rights division had access to these kids and were able to talk to them because they were staying in state facilities that were licensed by Washington. And one of the arguments these state attorneys generals are making, besides that kids are going to be traumatized by this indefinite incarceration, and once they're released into the states, that is something that states are going to have to, and the communities are going to have to contend with. Besides this trauma, they also are their ability to license and regulate some of these facilities that are supposed to be child care facilities will be undermined by these regulations. So you can expect to see in the future a lot of back and forth between more progressive state governments and also ICE. And I have a feeling that ICE is going to continue centering its operations more in red states, particularly in the South, Texas, Louisiana, where, you know, mass incarceration is a very big business already.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things related to that that I was running into constantly and everything I was reading about it is this whole the role of the Secretary of Homeland Security, and that ICE currently has the ability, they say, to hold 2,500 to 3,000 adults and children in residential facilities for families. But this is a deceptive figure. I think you've argued this. This is a deceptive figure. Overall, the Trump administration and ICE are caging at least 55,000 people. Let's talk about that a minute.
Sure. They are definitely caging about 55,000 people. What they're saying in these numbers is that the family residential that they have, which are basically two privately run facilities in Texas, that is what they're looking at basically reopening. That's what they're saying. However, the rule leaves it open for them to put as many people away as they want, as long as ICE says that the facilities meet certain standards. And that is what a lot of the people who want to see more oversight of this are concerned about. But we have to remember the centerpiece of their policy is mass incarceration. It's deterrence to mass incarceration. So, you know, the only reason they haven't been incarcerating more people than 55,000, now remember, some of those people are coming to the border. Some of them were also arrested inside the country after living here for a while. But the reason they're not incarcerating more is because people who come with kids, the kids under the settlement, the Flores settlement that they're trying to terminate, the kids can only be held for about 3 weeks before they have to be let go. And if you don't let their parents go with them, then you have a family separation. You remember how that went, the Trump administration last year. So they're trying to wriggle out of that to be able to incarcerate even more people than they already are. If you are a single man arriving at the border right now, the southern border, and you're an asylum seeker, and you're poor, and you're brown, and you're from a Central American country, it's quite likely that with the apparatus Trump already has set up, you're going to spend most of your stay in the United States until you see a judge to hear your case in jail. That's not the way it was for many years under Obama. It is the way under Trump. If you show up with a kid, that's a little bit different. And Trump and his folks in DHS are arguing that it's encouraging people to bring children with them. And so they want to lock children up too with their parents, and they want to give them the same treatment, where you don't get any freedom in this country until you see a judge. And, you know, I think any advocate for immigrant would argue, how are you supposed to gain any kind of support from your family? How are you supposed to raise money for a lawyer? How are you supposed to live and take care of your kids if you're locked away for the entire time that you're here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting, too, because one of the things I kept thinking about in reading this is exactly that point about, you know, you look at the mistreatment of children in relation to all this, and then you look at all the things that are being put out there that actually I think many people don't even recognize, you know, how things are developing, how quickly they're developing, and in what direction they're developing. I mean, I was even thinking about how many people are aware of the fact of just the role of private prisons in all this, and then what that means for it to go from being government-run prisons to these private prisons that are being established all over the country, and, you know, what impact that has on the future of immigrants and on people in general.
Sure. I mean, it's a lot of money. And I wrote a story for truthout.org that was titled Asylum Seekers Are Disappeared in Private Louisiana Jails. And I actually went to one of these privately run jails. And the folks who are being held there talked about on Gran Negocio, about the big business they were in, how they just felt the only purpose for their incarceration, the only purpose for being stuck there, is for one contractor to make a profit and another. Because these guys have been shipped around all over the country, and everywhere they go, someone's taking a piece of the pie, the bus driver, the prison warden at the new prison, the prison warden at the next prison, the phone company, when they go to call their family and their loved ones, is private and is taking a collection off their call. And so they literally feel like they're stuck in a big business. And I'll give you, you know, I'll tell you a little bit about one man I met there. And I changed his name for the story, but I called him Oscar. And I'll never forget this. He did not arrive to the country with any kids. He wouldn't be affected by this policy that came out last week. But he is part of the incarceration dragnet. And he lifted up his shirt, and the entire left side of his body was scarred. He had been set on fire and burned because he wasn't able to make an extortion payment. And he looks at me and he says, "No one flees because they want to." Mm. And that really stuck with me.
Yeah, I can imagine, man. Talk about the children a little bit more. I keep thinking that, you know, you think about it. Kids, you see these kids who, you know, just terrorized. And a lot of times, whether it's in a war scenario, whether it's, you know, their houses being raided by police, whatever. But that, here you have just how many, I don't know how many children it is that would come across the border, that would come across with their parents, would come across with somebody else, or somehow make their own way across. And then they find themselves locked up in these prisons that they have no idea what's going to happen to them. They could, you know, there's the mistreatment of children. There's the families locked in prison facilities until they are deported, you know, and this is all sort of concentrated in a way that really reminds you of the kinds of things like the Nazis going into certain cities and saying, okay, all the Jews, you're out of here. Get in the truck, go. And then, you know, they disappear in people's consciousness and people's, you know, in what people understand or what they see in the world. And I think that's something that they've been trying to do with this, where they're talking about, we're going to, you know, we're just spreading out the holding of undocumented. We're actually going to, you know, we're going to send them back to their own countries as quick as possible, as if it would then become a non-issue.
You know, and it's hard to report on the kids because they are minors, and consent for the media and also for other observers is something to be taken into consideration there. But we do have doctors going in. We do have investigators like the Civil Rights Division for the Attorney General in Washington. And they're getting interviews with these kids, and what has come out and what has leaked into the media and what is shown up in the headlines, I mean, it's beyond, there's no soap and toothbrushes. I mean, it's much worse than that. And you have to wonder if this is part of this broader deterrent strategy that we keep hearing about from the people at the top. And if it is really dehumanizing and abusing people, is that actually a legitimate political strategy? I mean, even the fact that I have to be wondering this, I think, is pretty scary and telling about the failure of the government to take care of people, most of whom are showing up here because they are in need. But I think that, you know, when you look at what is the motivation behind these policies, and, you know, it's pretty clear who our president is, what he's said about immigrants, and who his supporters are and what they've said. And at the end of the day, they really do want to send them back. They don't want to care for them, and maybe they don't think they're worthy to be in this country. And I think that is the kind of giant ideological divide that we're kind of facing as a country right now. And it's scary. You're right. You're right. It's really interesting times.
Well, you know, one of the things that just related to that, because I think there's an element, too, of, you know, look, Trump actually uses this. I mean, it's the same way the Nazis used the Jewish people and the gypsies and communists and other people, you know, to sort of be a focus for the anger and the reactionary assaults and everything for his followers, for his base followers, you know. And it's like, it's very, very heavy here because for Trump and the people around him, incarcerating immigrants, and I think you said this, it's red meat for the right wing base. Let's talk about that.
Sure. I mean, you know, you can look at any of my reporting about the broader prison industrial complex and just mass incarceration in general. And you can look at this point, you can look at work across the spectrum even. And we can see that, in general, mass incarceration, which we have responded to public health problems like drugs with mass incarceration. We have responded to problems like poverty with mass incarceration. Now we're responding to immigration with mass incarceration. Sure, it has been done before, and we should acknowledge that Trump is not the first to take a stab at least indefinite family detention. But he is the first to really put incarceration at the center of his policy and to basically make a show of inflicting pain, so to speak, because I would argue that incarceration is painful. And you have to wonder, when have we fixed a social problem with throwing people in cages? Has it worked for unemployment in urban and rural areas? Has it worked for drugs? No, we have, of course, a public health crisis when it comes to opioids right now, and criminalization has made it far worse. I think anyone who's looking at the science right now will tell you that. So in here we see this repeat again with people who are specifically from a certain part of the world and a few other parts of the world, most of those parts of the world poorer and browner than Europe or Canada. And this is how we're responding to a challenge, right? They are facing a challenge, and they're coming here, and they're asking for help. And we're responding with a policy of locking them up.
You know, one of the other things that happens, though, and I think this we should learn something off of this, what happened in Texas just a little while ago. Basically, look, here's the thing, man. You got people looking at these immigrants, Trump's people. I'm talking about those people, the Trump fascists, the fascist hordes he's pulling together successfully, pulling together all over the country. You know, and you think about this, when they're unleashed and they look at immigrants and they look at immigrants again, as you said, this thing about red meat for the right wing base. There's actually a reality of those people going out and doing things like killing people, beating people, attacking people. You know, and you think about what just happened down in Texas a little while ago, where people were shot because they were Latino. It's sort of whether or not they can prove that the person that did the shooting was, you know, and you know, sort of really dedicated to Trump. The ideological and the political, you know, position he was taking in his actions actually was concentrated in everything that Trump puts out to people in terms of these are the unwanted, these are the dirty, these are the ones that are causing all of our trouble. And I think that's something people really have to be aware of now.
Sure. You know, I've been reporting on immigration jails, county jails, city jails, state prisons, federal prisons, all this stuff for a long time now. And so have a number of my colleagues at Truth Out. In fact, my editor Maya Chenoir has written an entire book about decarceration, and we have a lot of really talented writers who write about abolition at Truth Out. And I think when you look at that body of work, but you also just look at the data, you look at what people who have been in the system have to say, whether that's an immigration jail or a state prison, you come to the conclusion that incarceration is violence, right? It's inherently violent to rob someone of their freedom and put them in a dehumanizing situation, control what they eat and what they do with their lives every day. And to serve that violence as a punishment for migrating along routes, you could argue people have been traveling for a long time before settlers showed up to this country, to respond to that with more violence. I think that sends a very strong message, particularly to other people who have a settler mentality and feel threatened by it. And I just hope that we don't see more horrendous violence like what we've already seen.
All right, Mike, we're going to wrap this up now, but I really want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Mike Ludwig, and you can find his articles on truthout.org. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. That was Steve Earle with City of Immigrants. All right, right now, we're going to bring to the air Andy Z. Now, you know, there's been a lot of discussion of different subjects that I wanted to talk with Andy about, but I was talking with him yesterday, and we kind of got into something, and I want to welcome him to the show first. Andy, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be back on.
Now, there's been a lot, I want to do this quick, but there's been a lot of discussion and wrestling with Donald Trump's comments about Jewish people, the things that he went through just over the last couple of weeks, and including that if Jews vote for Democrats, then they're being disloyal. And in doing this, he's trafficked in anti-Semitism. So I want to at least begin to open up what this is all about for a few minutes on this show, and I would like to hear some of what you're thinking about this. So run to it, man.
So look, all this stuff around the anti-Semitism and the forbidding the two members of the squad from going to Israel, and now this accusation of if you vote for the Democrats, you're not being loyal. All of this is should be both a wake-up call and food for thought. We're going to leave aside, though, Donald Trump's assertion that he's the chosen one and the king of Israel. We're just not going to go there right now and what that signifies about this man. But there are two points that I want to just open up for discussion. You know, we won't fully get to it all in this show. First, is that what's really bound up, one of the things that's bound up with the full array of Trump's remarks is that in a critical aspect, they really reveal the depth and the coherence of the full fascist program that he and his whole cabal and the Republican Party represent, which is the triad of American fascism, of white supremacy, xenophobia, and misogyny, and how that all gets wrapped together and interwoven with anti-Semitism. And in addition to that, it's an attack on the elite and cosmopolitanism. And these are all parts of what's a very classic and traditional fascist program. And I want to get into this some actually first, but let me just make the second point just in case we run out of time. There's also an important political and moral dimension to this in another aspect, that the Democrats have no answer to this, to his accusation, no answer that's morally and politically consistent to the charge that if Jews vote Democratic, they are being disloyal. Look, what you see, let me just do a little bit of history on this, that you have a situation now where a younger generation, or younger generations under 40 in particular, have come to see that the policies of Israel, at least they've come to see that the policies of Israel are inconsistent with their sense of morality and justice. I'm speaking here particularly of Jewish youth, although obviously people of color and these have also recognized it. But a large section of Jewish youth cannot reconcile the apartheid nature of Israel and what happened here with Black Lives Matter and how what was going on in Gaza and all this. And this has provided a big problem for the Democratic Party and actually for the system as a whole. Because, you know, what Trump has been saying is that Trump is, because the Democratic Party has, as a ruling class party, has been committed to the state of Israel. You're committed to this. It's all sections of the ruling class. This is a basic litmus test, and there's a longer history of how Israel was set up as a settler and apartheid state, you know, and with the support of imperialism, British French imperialism, and that for the U.S., it's been a linchpin, a centerpiece of their foreign policy to dominate the oil resources and the gateway between Asia and Europe for some time, that Israel could be their Fort Apache, as that's sometimes called it. So this is now being torn asunder in terms of there's a section of the Democrats who have been opposing this, or at least the Democratic base, and now Trump is working on that division. And what's really a classic Trump thing and what's unique about it is that he is accusing people of being Jews, of being anti-Semitic, if they vote for the Democrats, at the same time that he is trafficking in the violent anti-Semitism. So in other words, he's accusing anti-Semitism on the basis of anti-Semitism, which is a unique position. And in fact, one of the things that could come out of this, and basically what's on offer from Trump to the mainstream of that party, is we'll put you on this side of the fascist divide, but you have to really come over to our full program. You have to be with us if you want to support the state of Israel, and this is part of a division in society as a whole. And so, just before going back to the question of the classic anti-Semitism that's involved here and what it reveals about fascism, you know, I do want to make two points. One is, I think all of this shows there's something that the revolutionary leader whose work I study and follow, and political leadership I follow, Bob Avakian, had made a comment once, which was, after the Holocaust, the state of Israel is the worst thing to happen to Jewish people. And it's a very profound statement. We could spend an hour on it, getting into how it is that people were divided, people who were largely an oppressed people throughout Europe, throughout history for millennia, and had largely played a progressive role in struggles over centuries, became actually a force for, if you will, reaction in the world that was all hinged on the state of Israel and essentially being played in a very vicious way. But the two points I want to make here on the Democrats, this is food for thought, but it should also indicate to people what we're going to have to do to drive out the Trump-Pence regime, which is not rely on the Democrats as a ruling class party, not rely on the established political structures, but actually get in the streets and our millions and sustain nonviolent struggle. And I would like people to be thinking about what my fundamental purpose is is to get into the understanding the nature of this imperialist system in America and how all sections of the ruling class are committed to not just standing with the apartheid settler state, but making this an article of, yes, faith. And that's why I'm working today to organize people to begin to prepare now for the time when we could overthrow the system. But if I could go back, Michael, now to this first point about the triad of fascism, is that okay? Can I take some time to do that?
A few minutes, yeah.
Okay, well, I think it is important to understand and look at how, you know, this anti-Semitism and how he's been putting this in the whole array of the comments over the last period really echoes, not only the classic anti-Semitic trope of divided loyalty to Jews as Jews and not to their country, which, you know, it's a whole topic in its own, which I just spoke to in terms of the current situation of the Democrats. But even more, what he's, what he's getting at here, and what's really, you know, you can see this expressed in the Jews will not replace us at Charlottesville. You can see this in the mass murders at synagogues, and particularly if you dive into the depth of this fascist base that he's not just signifying to, but actually unleashing, whether he's doing it fully consciously or not, I don't know, but it's certainly working, to where he's saying that the Jewish, and what is being said, He's not saying all of this, but what's being said is, and he signifies it, is that the Jews are behind an elite conspiracy to actually bring immigrants into this country to and into Europe, too, to fuel this immigrant flood into this country and to turn the good white people into, quote-unquote, a Mongol race by interbreeding. This is all up in these fascist websites and in the fascist train of thought. It was what the Nazis promoted. But it's the Jews who can do this. Sometimes these people even talk about Jews shape-shifting, that they're not really white people, but they're really people who have this other agenda. So you can see where this anti-Semitism wraps up with the white supremacy, the xenophobia, the hatred of the foreigner. This is not new. There was a whole famous case. People can look up the Dreyfus case in France that actually required Jews then to sign a loyalty pledge to France itself. So it's white supremacy, xenophobia, and the disgusting misogyny against miscegenation and mixing of races that all gets put on this Jewish conspiracy that sits over here. And this is part of the whole attack of these Christian fascists on what, you know, by analogy could be called Weimar, which is the equivalent of the liberals in Germany in the 30s, the intellectuals, and of which the Jews are not the only ones, and actually were excluded for many years from universities and culture, even as now they play a more prominent role in those spheres. So I did want to bring all of this in because this should tell people that this is not just the rantings of a lunatic, which he probably is. He's certainly a narcissist, but there's actually a very coherent fascist philosophy and signifying and coherence of a movement that is around this triad, and we better take that seriously. And then the second point of understanding that the Democrats have no answer, and so that if you're waiting for 2020, I just have to say it's immoral to do this to the people who are now suffering directly under the boot of this, but it's also something that is not going to work. If I would ask people, what do you do if he wins the election? Then what do you do? And what do you do if he loses the election but doesn't leave office? Also a possibility. These are questions that Avakian also posed in a recent article available on revcom.us.
All right, Andy.
Some of what I'm thinking about.
All right, good. That's very. Now you've got everybody thinking about this, which is good. All right. All right, Andy, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And now we got to run.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was Andy Z.
That brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer, Kiana Williams. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going to go out now with Earthquake in the Heart of Rome from Ghetto Priest. Talk to you again next week.
Heart of Rome, earthquake in the heart of Rome.